Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Charles Stanley Wealth Managers. Charles Stanley is committed to providing financial peace of mind through personalized financial planning and expert investment management. To find out more, visit www.charles-stanley.co.uk. Investment involves risk. I'm Freddie Sayers, and this is Unheard. We've talked a lot about the war in Ukraine on this channel. We've had military experts, political theorists. Unheard has even had multiple reporters on the ground. Some of the voices we've heard from take a cautious, even skeptical line. They're worried about escalation risks, the need for some kind of peace deal to emerge. Well, today's guest offers a very different perspective. She's a Ukrainian MP and professor, deputy leader of the Holos pro-European opposition party, and she was deputy minister of education and science from 2014 onwards. She's one of the most eloquent voices explaining the Ukrainian position. So we couldn't think of anyone better to gently challenge on those escalation risks, on what a realistic ending for the war might be, whilst also trying to understand her perspective and what she's going through on the ground. She joins us from Kyiv. Welcome to Unheard.
Thank you for having me.
So you're talking to us from Kyiv. I guess I should start by asking, we've seen some images in recent days of explosions and threats in Kyiv. What's the atmosphere like now, and what's day-to-day life like?
Well, I'll tell you this. Indeed, there have been, since May 1st, 17 or 18 nights when explosions were heard basically in all parts of the city. So you can imagine that's basically every other night. That is extremely disturbing, I'll tell you this. I don't necessarily always get the air raid alert, something everybody has an app on their phones. Then there is also an outside air raid alert. But sometimes you are just too tired over the night. You just don't hear that. But then you wake up in the middle of the night because of the very loud explosions. And literally your heart starts bumping and your hands are trembling and then they go numb. At least that's my physical reaction. That is something very, very scary. That's something that nobody wants to wake up to. And this has been indeed happening almost every other night. This night it was okay. There were no explosions. But it's basically like this. You go to bed and you don't know when explosions are going to happen. There are many people that my team is joking, like, okay, I'm going to bed earlier so that I have enough sleep before the explosions start.
And people are using the subway, is that right, if they're anxious about the explosions?
Well, if it is somewhere really close, then yeah, you go to the bomb shelter or to the subway station. Well, the subway station would often be the closest bomb shelter to you. But I think that the basic rule that that everybody is following is at least be in the room that doesn't have any windows. That is the minimum requirement. And I think you understand if it happens every other night, you simply cannot be spending every other night in metro station. So I think I'm just trying to hide my son and myself in the wardrobe, basically.
And yet life seems to be going on in, to some degree in Kyiv, and you know, restaurants are open and nightclubs, and is that true? I mean, how much is normal life carrying on despite this background threat?
Well, life goes on. I think, to begin with, before the big war started, I was watching many movies about war, and I was thinking, like, people behave strangely at wartime. You would think that they would behave differently, but they go to restaurants, and that seemed weird when you watch that on in a TV or in a film. And then you leap through this and you realize that, yeah, life goes on. I mean, you still do lots of stuff for the war. My partner is with the army. You know, my son goes to the bomb shelter at school when there is an air raid a lot. But you still need to buy food. You still need to have coffee to wake up in the way I need coffee after those nightly explosions and so on and so forth. So, yeah, it can seem like from the outside, if you just take a snapshot, it seems all right. But then you see signs of abnormality. One of them being there is enormous number of people in military uniform on the streets. And that is something that I still keep on noticing. Is like, that is something we didn't have 2 years ago. But there are many, many people wearing uniform right now. You go to your social media and you read yet another post of someone, friend of a friend, being wounded or killed in action and so on and so forth. So it might look like more or less normal because people have to leave. You know, I have to. No, my son will not have another childhood. So I do take him to McDonald's when he gets, you know, sometimes, or you know, we get pizza because again, he's not going to get another childhood. So I have to take care of that. But I think that you have to understand that those are signs of normality, but not really normal life itself.
What about politics? Because this is something that I guess doesn't get a lot of airtime, but you're technically an opposition MP. Your party falls into the opposition group. Is politics continuing to some degree? Are there opposition voices to President Zelensky, or is it this sense that because there's a war going on, you know, no criticism is appropriate?
There are several issues where indeed politics is limited. One is communication, any communication on the issues of defense and army and on international cooperation. When we go in different delegations to trip abroad, we always speak one voice because it's about all, and it's not because it's been censored and not because we have been forced to do so, but because the situation for us as the country is so black and white, like we need more weapons to survive and we need our partners to continue supporting us. Regardless of which party you belong to, this is basic true for survival of us as politicians in the country. Because you know that is dependent upon the country's survival. So there is no different voices on that. And then there is one matter when there is indeed, I would call it not censorship. It's censorship. You are not allowed to publish in or to speak about information about like where weapons are being located or you know all this stuff related
security to security issues.
Yeah, security issues. But other than that, yeah, life goes on and politics goes on. There are issues that we disagree on internal politics, even though, of course, like internal politics itself just takes up much less time right now because we are all focused on helping the army and making sure that we survive as a nation. But there is still issues of internal politics that we debate or that we disagree on, where different parties or different members of parliament have different positions. I'll give you one example. An issue I'm working closely on is LGBT rights and the introduction of same-sex partnerships in Ukraine. I'm the main initiator of the bill, the main author of the bill. And yes, there is politics involved around that issue that, rose quite lots of debates. So that is one example where politics is still there.
Because a lot of people don't realize that President Zelensky and his party was sort of it wasn't pro-Russian, but it was, at the time when he was elected, considered more accommodating, more conciliatory with the Russian voices. And your party was among those that was a more strongly pro-European opposition voice. Is there any of that sort of flavour still there? Or is it the sense that everyone now sees this in more of a similar way?
It's more like everybody sees it like we did before.
Right.
Yeah, I'll tell you this, both in politics, but also in the society, I think the situation have changed. Now the level of support for us becoming EU members is 90%. For us becoming NATO members is 80%+. It was different numbers 2 years ago. And I think President's party were trying to balance between different positions. We were more straightforward, like we need to go to EU, we need to become NATO members, we need to fight corruption. So we were very straightforward. They were in it more, I wouldn't say, they definitely were not pro-Russian, but they were more vague and they were trying to balance different positions in the society. But waking up to explosions in your city kind of changes your perspective quite a lot.
The atmosphere over here, I'm sure you've been traveling during this period, but it's nothing like what you're experiencing, but there is still a sense of tension, and that if in the media people make comments that are deemed to be not supportive enough of Ukraine, then they can get in a lot of trouble on social media. It's tense, I would say. Are there any voices inside Ukrainian social media that are also, you know, if they start talking about accommodations, or they start talking about freezing the conflict, or they start talking about negotiations, are there such voices?
No. There probably so there have been several. I'm trying to think about that. There have been several media, bloggers that have been very active in promoting Russian, pro-Russian, let's accommodate, let's have a deal, and let's make peace, so on and so forth. They're still present. They have much less followers now, and even they have changed their rhetoric. There is one blogger that keeps springing in my mind. He definitely changed his position right now. So he still has his followers, but his position is now the opposite. He needs to be punished for what he did before, and it was clearly he was being paid off by Russians. There are no doubts about that. But he has not been kind of censored by the government. But I think people's position have just changed so dramatically. But no, I wouldn't say that there are many people who would. I can't even think of anybody, truly. We mostly disagree on issues of internal politics, but there are no big debates on foreign policy, no.
Okay, well, let me share some issues that we've been coming across. So most recently today, in fact, there was an interview in the Times of London with a member of the Free Russia Legion. This is a pro-Ukrainian but originally Russian militia, I guess, that is based in Ukraine and is making sorties into Russian territory. He says, quote, "We are not a band of criminals or a private military company like Wagner. We fight within the structure of Ukrainian forces." So what's your understanding of that? These anti-Russian but originally Russian groups that are making sort of raids, I guess, into Russian territory. Are they acting with the endorsement of the Ukrainian government?
I haven't read the interview itself, but that's a good point. I would definitely have a look at that. And of course, I cannot comment on issues that that are related to military or intelligence. And I'm not private to all those conversations, which is good, right? So I think that needs to be made clear. But let's be realistic. Are they... Can we say that we like what they're doing? Yes, of course. Because the inroads into Belgorod region is something that truly helps Ukraine. In what way? I'm originally from Kharkiv. Kharkiv is the second biggest city in Ukraine, or at least it used to be. It's literally 40 kilometers away from Russian border. And it's a border in Belgorod region from the Russian side. And Kharkiv has been shelled from Belgorod for 15 months now, almost every day. And even if this war ends tomorrow and Russian troops withdraw completely into Russian territory, Kharkiv will always be within reach of the Russian artillery. It's 40 kilometers. They don't even need missiles to hit Kharkiv. So the idea that this Free Russia Legion have been promoting, we want to make demilitarized territory in Belgorod, it's very close to my heart as a person born and raised in Kharkiv. I would guess that, yes, there is some sort of coordination with Ukrainian military and intelligence.
It looks like they were using Humvees and kind of American hardware, which is where it gets controversial, because obviously, yes, you know, the West has been providing this equipment on the idea that they wouldn't be used beyond the Russian border, and now it looks like they are. What should people in the West make of that?
Well, those reports have never been confirmed. We have only read them in the Russian pro-regime Putin's media. So that is not a trustworthy source. So I truly cannot add it.
I think Bellingcat, which is cannot really be described as a pro-Russian source, has identified the American hardware being used by that group. So I don't think that's controversial.
I haven't seen the Bellingcat report, but I do think I was following very closely whether there will be any like negative reaction on that from the American side, and it seems like they keep on saying we're investigating. So that is as much reaction as we got from the American authorities, at least from the American administration. So I guess people need to understand that even if this is happening, we are within our right to protect ourselves. We never wanted to be anywhere apart from Ukraine. We never wanted to invade Russia. We never have been a threat to Russia. But now our whole livelihoods have been destroyed. Our lives have been destroyed. And we need to make everything possible for us to survive. There is no way that we want anyone to go through what we are going through. And there is no way that we want to, because I know there are opposition voices in some countries, or like, you know, even pro-Russian groups claiming like, oh, Ukraine wants to drag other countries into this conflict. No, even we don't want to be in this conflict. We don't want this war for ourselves. We definitely don't want other countries to experience what we are experiencing. What we have to do is to stop this war. And the only way to stop is to win militarily. And if there are any actions that kind of have forced Russians to relocate their forces, let's say in Belgorod, from Ukrainian territory, then it's good for us, because then they relocate within their territory, but then we can liberate our territory somewhere else.
Would you say then that realistically, incursions into Russian territory is part of any Ukrainian victory plan, and that it's sort of naive to think that the activity could be contained entirely in Ukraine? I mean, should we expect to see more of this?
I don't know the whole plan. I know that, but what I'm sure of is that we are not planning to take over any Russian territory. That's for sure. We don't want that. We don't need that. We don't want to be, to have people living in those territories to be part of our country. Like, trust me, we don't want that. All we want is to liberate the territory that is ours within internationally recognized borders. So no, we're definitely not planning a raid towards Moscow. That's I'm absolutely sure of. But can there be some tactical moves to force Russians to relocate their forces and thus help us liberate our territories? Yes, that is within realm of possible. Yes.
Because, I mean, I just was looking at your Twitter feed after the drone attack happened on the Kremlin, you tweeted, Ukrainians have two big dreams, one to win the war, two to see how the Kremlin burns. The second dream almost came true last night. Russian media report that Kremlin caught fire. Nice to be continued? Will you expand on that? I mean, will you say that you were jesting, or is there a sincere desire to see more of that?
I mean, like, do we have, there are multiple memes and multiple pictures you will see of the Kremlin burning. That is something, do we imagine that? Yes, trust me, they have taken so much away from us. Then destroying this center of evil is, yes, something that we would like to happen. But it doesn't mean that we want to do it ourselves. You know, if there are pro-Russian groups that want to change regime in Russia, they should be doing that. All we want is to make sure that they leave us alone. That is as far as we can dream of. So, yeah, to be continued, yes, maybe I believe that there will be some action happening in Russia. And it needs to happen in order for Russian regime to change. It needs to happen. But trust me, we don't want to be doing this ourselves. It's too costly. Look, my partner is with the army, as I did mention. All I want is for him. I don't want him to liberate Moscow. I don't want him to go anywhere beyond Ukrainian border. That's as much as we all want to happen. So I think anything apart from that is just tactical moves that aim at the single goal, which is liberating our territory.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Here is where it gets difficult and sensitive, which is that if the goal is to get Western support to continue and weapons to carry on flooding in, I know there's talk of F-16s or fighter jets, and there's a sort of escalating requirements on the weapons front. It's important that you also don't spook your Western supporters. So I wonder whether tweets like that or, you know, will make voices inside Western governments anxious about giving further weapons because, well, the Ukrainian government says they're not going to be used inside Russia, but people are quite overtly saying they want them to be. Do you think there's a danger there?
I think it's I understand the question. I understand where the concern can come from. Yet again, everybody on the West needs to understand that we are not moving outside of our territory into the East. That's 100% sure. Like, everything else is tactical moves that help us liberate our territory. That is the only thing that we all want. I don't want my partner to be within Russian borders. I don't want that. I don't want anyone else from with a Ukrainian passport to be on the Russian border. They have to deal with their regime by themselves. We don't want to deal with that. And I believe that as long as this is the only goal that we are pursuing, which is to liberate Ukrainian territories. I understand there is lots of very intense communication between the military commands in Ukraine and in the US and the UK and in the EU. And I believe that our military command explains the certain details of the plan of how we are going to liberate their territory. And I believe that as long as Western military commands understand that this is our military plan, and that we are not going anywhere beyond our own border, then they are fine with that. And we are not going anywhere beyond. We are not liberating Russia, trust me.
So you think they would tolerate, the West will have a tolerance for kind of what are considered tactical moves inside Russian territory as long as it doesn't look like an actual seizing of territory?
It seems to be so far, right? There have not been any major backlashes from the Western side about that. So I hope there is an understanding. Again, here I'm a member of opposition party in the parliament. I'm not making military decisions and I'm not privy to all those communications. But I believe that for the West, it's important to see that the only thing we're doing is you know, in line with this big goal, which is, you know, which is basically helping us win the war and liberating our own territory. And so it seems to me that they see that this is what is happening right now, that we're not doing anything more than that.
Let's just be really clear about what that means, because presumably by our own territory you mean the full internationally recognized Ukrainian border, which is pre-2014, that includes Crimea. Is that universal also within kind of Ukrainian elite opinion, I guess, that recapturing Crimea is an integral part of what you would consider an acceptable outcome?
Yes. There is no debate about that. Crimea is part of the Ukrainian territory. It was annexed illegally, with the whole world basically ignoring this, unfortunately. And we need to get Crimea back for multiple reasons. Reason number one, which is probably most important, is strategically. Crimea has, because of its strategic location, if Russians continue to control Crimea, they will always use it as the basically military basis from which they can, you know, they can launch yet another attack in 5 years. So if we stop there and Russians just keep Crimea, they will continue militarizing it, and we will always will be living under this threat that this can happen again. And I don't want this to happen in the lifetime of my son. He's going to be 18 in 8 years, so I don't want him to fight this war again. Like, we want to be done with this. So strategically, from the military strategic standpoint, that is clearly, we need to control this territory. Secondly, of course, it's international law. We cannot just allow another country to redraw the borders. It's just drawn, not just for us, but also for the whole world order. And thirdly, which is no less important, Crimea is the native land of Crimean Tatars. It's an ethnic minority within Ukraine. Crimean Tatars are literally called Crimean Tatars. That is the only territory which is their homeland. And Russians have deported them in 1946, and they continue to do this right now. There are hundreds of Crimean Tatars who are in prison now just because they're Crimean Tatars. So we have to bring some justice to these people as well.
So I guess I can completely understand all of those three reasons. I think that makes perfect sense from the Ukrainian ideal outcome scenario. But there are lots of sensible senior people within Western governments, by no means Russian apologists, but people in the British administration, French, and I believe American as well, who take a slightly different view. And they think that full recapturing of Crimea is not realistic or likely as an outcome in this conflict, and that actually the escalation risk of trying to make that happen, given that it's such a vast Russian military base and is considered now such a kind of integral part of their worldview, is a risk not worth taking in terms of escalation. And it might actually lead to some kind of nuclear event, and people are worried about it. What do you say to those people? I mean, there are people across the West, I think, good people, who, while they completely sympathize and feel very moved by what's happened in Ukraine, are also worried that it's an escalation risk, that Russia is a very armed nuclear power, and we don't want to be foolhardy. What do you say to them?
One, we are not suicidal. My son lives here in Ukraine. I never moved him out of the country. He's been, since the day one of the big war, he's been away of the country for 5 days. All the rest of the time, he's here. So trust me, if I were to see that there is some escalation or nuclear threat potential, the first thing I would do, I would take my son away. And I think that is, everybody watching this will understand the feeling. And of course, I don't want to lead to the situation where this threat can actually be realistic. Look, Chernobyl is literally 2 hours drive from here. We are the country, the only country in the world that understands very clearly what a nuclear threat is. We don't want that to happen again. So, here I get back to your initial question. Is there a debate inside Ukrainian political field about Crimea? There is no debate that we need to get Crimea back, but there is debate about how we do this. Do we wait till Putin dies and then we do this? This is one scenario. And this is realistic, and then that can be an acceptable scenario in under some circumstances, right? If there is a chance that we take it back militarily, ensuring that there is no nuclear escalation, yeah, we can go this path. So there are debates about how exactly we can do this, and I think that is correct. We should again, none of us is suicidal. None of us want to be living through this. So I think there are debates about how to achieve this goal. It's just that we don't debate the goal itself. And that is the message that I would like to convey to the Western elites.
So would you be worried then if there was a straightforward military incursion into Crimea? Would you be worried about the risk of nuclear escalation? Do you think that is a legitimate fear?
It is a legitimate fear. We do have the tablets that you need to take in case of the nuclear. Not something I wanted to have at my home. That's very scary. But so far, our military command and our intelligence have been pretty smart, and I continue to trust that our military and intelligence will make sure that if they make the decision to go into Crimea, it will be based on understanding that it will not lead to nuclear escalation. That is something none of us wants here. None of us. So, and neither do the military command. So we
got to have a pretty firm understanding, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
So
yes.
I'm almost detecting in the way you spoke about that previous idea that you could have almost as a long-term objective to take back Crimea. You know, you said when Putin dies or at some future moment. It reminds me of a piece that actually went up on Politico today, I think. I think we can put that on the screen. It says, Ukraine could join ranks of frozen conflicts, US officials say. And the argument here is that because both sides have publicly stated goals that are so obviously incompatible and that we don't want it just to be war for years and years and years, there could be a scenario in which the conflict kind of freezes in some state where the long-term objectives remain, but the fighting stops. Do you think that is a plausible short or medium-term outcome?
It is plausible. However, it's not the best thing that can happen. Why? Because we have to remember that for us, we are living in the ninth year of war. For us, the war started in 2014. So for us, this has been a frozen conflict. And living in the country which is living in the frozen conflict is very unpleasant. It's an impediment to economic development. You always have to find like different solutions. Like, I'll give you a very simple example. In what way it kind of stalls all the other things that need to be happening in Ukrainian society. I did serve as first deputy minister of education and science in 2014, 2016. Half of my work was literally making up rules and procedures and everything for kids from occupied territory in Crimea and from occupied territories in Donbas, how to make sure that they can get into Ukrainian universities. It's like 10% of the kids, but it takes up 50-60% of the workings of the ministry to make sure that you come up with some sort of solutions for those kids. And it's the same for like Ministry of Public Health. Like, what do we do with people who had COVID there? Do we treat them? Do we not? Like, it just, having this frozen conflict, it always takes away a huge part of the resources of the country, both mental, administrative, political as well, because it raises, like, every time this raises issue politically. So living in the country which does have a frozen military conflict, it means that the country will not be developing. And this is very sad. And this will mean that people will continue to leave. They will not come back. The economy will collapse. So that is why I don't want this to turn into frozen conflict.
But is that still, I guess, you know,
it's a possibility. Yes.
It must be even sadder to be living in a country where people are dying in their thousands and tens of thousands in a hot conflict. So I guess in the scale of tragedy, would that be preferable to an ongoing war that lasts years and years?
Well, preferably we would not be in any sort of war. And it's just extremely unfair that we have to do this and we have to live through this. We never chose to do this. We never chose this to be our path. And I think that is what the world needs to remember is like the world needs to help those who were attacked without any provocation. And I think that is what the world, like, we need to stop this and we need to make sure that Russia is just leaves us alone and does whatever they want within their territory. Because either option, like having the options of living in the frozen conflict or in an active war zone, I don't want either. I want to live in my own country and deal with our own society and how we develop. And that is all we want, like any other country. It's extremely unfair that we are presented with these two choices, which neither of them you want to, for your children to live in.
Let me conclude by asking about a kind of future scenario, because we don't often talk or think about what might happen later after such a deal may or may not be struck. How secure do you think President Zelensky is? I mean, is there any concern that the sort of ultra-nationalist groups that are now very well armed by the West might not accept whatever deal or frozen conflict or whatever President Zelensky ultimately suggests and wants to endorse? Do you think there's a risk that there are now groups within Ukraine that basically won't stop even when he says we should stop?
I don't understand what are the ultra-nationalist groups that are very well armed. The only groups that are armed in Ukraine are the Ukrainian army. We call them ultra-nationalists because they fight for our country. Well, then all other armies in the world are also ultra-nationalists. It's difficult to speculate about that because we don't know what sort of solutions that will be, under what circumstances, and in which situation, in which context. So I think, of course, the only solution that 100% of the society will be happy about is us winning the war, liberating our territory completely, and that's it. Any other scenario will be unpleasant for some people, that's for sure. And it will, again, I would also believe it will not be the best one that we can get. So we should aim for more, because only more is basically the only acceptable solution for us, is just getting our lives back. So it's kind of difficult to comment on that because it just, there are many unknowns in that and too many variables even to try to imagine that. I know we have to do today, tomorrow, in a week from now. That unfortunately, we don't have, coming up with solutions for what if is.
I guess not... what I really meant was sort of returning to where we started, where we were talking about normal politics in Ukraine, democratic politics. Do you worry that your political opponents in normal times have been sort of empowered during this wartime? You might find there are kind of really quite unsavory groups and political people that now have a lot more power than they used to. Is that something we should worry about?
There are people in power I don't like. There are people that have been within the last couple of months quite lots of anti-corruption investigations that revealed corruption by certain officials in Ukraine and power. And I don't want those people to get any more power, and I want that to get punished. The good part of that is that those investigations were conducted by official anti-corruption bodies that have been established within the last 8 years in Ukraine and which are now producing results. I'm not happy about that. Of course, I'm not. And I want Ukraine to win this war as a democratic state. That's absolutely a given. We don't want to win this war as anything else, less than that. But we do have a very strong civil society, and we do have a very strong political tradition, which I'm sure will make sure, which will kind of ensure that this happens. Ukraine will always be democratic. It can be a messy democracy, but it will always be democratic. That's something I'm absolutely sure about. And then we get back to business as usual, when politicians will offer different, plans for the country, and then the society will choose which plan they like better. But what I'm sure of is Ukraine now is on its sixth president. Russia is on the second and a half, if you count Medvedev as an independent figure. We are a democracy. We have always been, and I'm sure we will continue to be.
Inna Sovsun, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
That was Inna Sovsun, Ukrainian MP, deputy leader of the Holos opposition party, giving us her perspective from the ground in Kiev. I tried to gently challenge on some escalation risks and possible realistic endings for this war, whilst being mindful that it was kind of her to give us the time, so thanks to her. What's clear is that she doesn't consider it her role to look for compromise or create solutions based on realpolitik, and you can understand that. She is fighting for the survival of her country day by day. Thanks to her, and thanks to you for tuning in. This was Unheard.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.